The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing. Not because they are easy, but because they are hard.
We have made it to start. 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting for 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good morning, listeners. Welcome to our Friday morning Space Show program, and I am your host, David Livingston. Thank you for tuning in. Quick, short announcement, and that is we're using the 60-minute format today. So, again, look at your clocks, and if you have a question or comment for our guests, make sure you get them in, not at the 11th hour, but in time that we can address them during today's program. And we certainly appreciate that very much. A couple of other quick announcements. Our toll-free number for those of you that can use it, 1-866-687-7223. Remember, no call screeners. Let the phone ring, and we'll bring you up on air as quickly as possible. Email drspace, D-R-S-P-A-C-E, at thespaceshow.com. And then you can also post comments on our blog, which is on our website, all the way over to the upcoming show menu. And then this is the first program listed. Just open that page and scroll down to the bottom for comments. And those are the three ways you can interact with our guests today. Of course, the phone is our preferred way. So again, 1-866-687-7223. Remember to check the website newsletter. It shows all of the programs we have planned between now and the end of the year. There are still a couple of open dates. If you have guest suggestions, please send them to me. I would love to follow up on them, and we'll do so. New website newsletter will be published on Monday morning. And everything we do is archived. You can listen right off the website or download our program. It is a holiday period, so check out our store. It's in the upper left menu. And then remember also that we're about to start our annual campaign. The Space Show is a 501c3 nonprofit, and we are listener-funded. So if you like our programming and you like interacting with our guests and talking with them in the blog, please do support us. And is a 501c3. Your gift is tax-deductible if you're paying U.S. federal taxes. The same is true for those of you paying California taxes. If you have any questions, visit our nonprofit parent site, onegiantleapfoundation.org, or simply email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com. On our homepage, you'll see supporting the Space Show. So here is information for supporting us through PayPal, as well as mailing a check to One Giant Leap Foundation. Also, there's information on using Amazon to support the Space Show. If you're an habitual Amazon user like I am, you can get most of your purchases set up to support the Space Show. They give a percentage of your purchase price to approved nonprofits, and One Giant Leap is an approved nonprofit. So click on the big Amazon link, and it will explain the two programs we have with Amazon. And again, if you have any questions, don't hesitate to email me. We also have sponsors, and we're getting ready to open up sponsors for 2019. They do get a banner ad running across our homepage. You can change that banner ad as often as you like. And on full-length, longer shows, I read a sponsor message. But on the shorter shows like today, I simply name our sponsors and thank them, because without our great sponsors, we probably wouldn't be doing the show either. So we certainly thank Northrop Grumman, the AIAA, Celestis, the Space Development Network, the National Space Society, the Integrated Space Plan, and the Space Foundation. So if you want more information about any of these sponsors, you can certainly email me, and I can put you in touch with people, or you can get it directly off of their website or the web. And again, if you have any questions about sponsoring and supporting the Space Show, One Giant Leap, please do let me hear from you. So I'm happy to bring back to the show Dr. Michael Wall. And Michael is a senior writer at space.com, and he has written extensively about the search for alien life. His work has appeared in Scientific American, NBC News, and a number of other outlets. Before becoming a writer, he earned a PhD in biology from the University of Sydney in Australia and has 15 peer-reviewed publications. He is based in San Francisco, where he chronicles the space tech revolution in Silicon Valley. Michael has a new book out that I've read, and I urge all of you to get a hold of it. It also would make a great holiday present. It's titled Out There, A Scientific Guide to Alien Life, Antimatter, and Human Space Travel, and then parentheses, for the cosmically curious. The book, I guess it's already out in November, correct, Michael?
Yeah, it comes out on like November 13th. But you can order it now off Amazon if you so desire.
So I have an advanced media copy, and listeners, I assure you, if this is a topic you like, you will be fascinated with it. It's not just alien life. It's much broader than that. Michael, great to have you back on the show. Tell us a little bit about why you decided to do this. And one of the questions I have for you, that, you know, in the space world and in the science world, and you do have a science PhD, you know, there's a lot of stigma to those that write about ET, alien life, unless you do it in a way that science sort of blesses you, like SETI is okay to talk about it. There's a few other ways to talk about it, but certainly not the way that it gets talked about on different websites and paranormal radio shows and all of that. So tell us about your interest in alien life, and do you sort of thread a needle on not getting dismissed in the science and journalistic community because you have an interest in the subject, or do you thread that needle real carefully? I'm interested in how you handle it.
Yeah, that's part of the reason why I actually wanted to write this book now, and it's just it's a really interesting time, because this is not as fringe as it used to be. I mean, 10 or 20 years ago even, I mean, astrobiology was pretty marginal, and yeah, there actually was a real stigma attached to it, but I think that's changed. I mean, Kepler's telescope has put us on the exoplanets there are up there. Pretty much every star has at least one planet on average, and about a quarter of them could be pretty Earth-like. And, I mean, we're finding out there's more than one habitable planet in our own solar system, our own habitable world. I mean, we've got these ocean moons in the outer solar system that could have life swimming in them. It's just, I mean, all this stuff has been happening really recently in the last decade or so. And so, yeah, I mean, I think that's kind of why I wanted to actually write about this. And also, I just find it fascinating. And, I mean, I've always been interested in the evolution of sort of life on Earth, and then that makes you think about, are we alone? Obviously, lots of people think about that question. It's one of the fundamental questions. But now we're at the stage where we can tackle that question pretty scientifically based on what we're learning. And it's like in this book, you know, I mean, it's a lot of speculation, because all we have is what's on Earth. All we can do is kind of take our knowledge of what happened here on Earth and kind of extrapolate, but do it in a responsible way. Like, you can speculate about what we might expect to find, what could be out there. I mean, you can use what happened here on Earth as a guide and make some informed, kind of educated guesses. And that's basically what I do in the book. Don't go all wild and crazy. Kind of use what we know to make some kind of educated guesses.
Listeners, this is not your normal science ET alien life book. So I'm just going to run through a little bit of his table of contents to give you an idea of how out there, in many ways of understanding what out there means, Michael is talking about, and why this is such a special, really terrific book. So he's got a chapter about, where is everybody? Are we all Martians? What does ET look like? How about this one? Do aliens have sex? What are we looking for? Where is ET hiding? How would the world be told? Would we be able to talk to an ET? So he's talking about sentient life. Have we already found it? Would aliens kill us? Then he gets into more or less policy that all of us are interested in. Will we colonize the moon and Mars? Can we go interstellar? Time travel? and he takes a look into the future about what will happen to us. So, you know, Michael, that this is a great book with topics that you don't get to hear discussed in a legitimate kind of scientific critical thinking way. So I commend you on that. Were you a little nervous in writing this book and going out there, so to speak? Out there meaning you're kind of out on a limb, maybe?
No, I mean, I wouldn't say so. Just because I've been writing about this sort of stuff for the past 8 years at space.com, and so I've talked to a lot of scientists, and basically what I did in the book is I talked to a lot of people. I talked to a lot of astrobiologists, study scientists, planetary scientists, NASA officials. I mean, people who are doing this kind of work on the ground. So yeah, I mean, I wasn't really all that nervous about it. I mean, sure, there's a community out there who does kind of go after the paranormal aspects of it and kind of focus on, have we been like visited? What are UFOs? And have people been abducted? I don't spend a lot of time on that sort of stuff in the book. I'm more interested in sort of what we think we can kind of figure out, like, about alien life. You know, is it likely to be microbial? If, where are the worlds where it might be hiding? How are we looking for it? Like, yeah, I'm sort of more interested in the scientific aspects of it and what we know and what we think we know. There is a chapter about, like, have we already found ET that talks about, like, the Allen Hills meteorite? Did the Viking, like, landers find life on Mars? And it talks a little bit about UFOs and about, like, alien abduction stuff. But, I mean, yeah, I don't get into that as much, the paranormal side of things, because I think that's a lot of, like, psychology, and that's a whole other book, I think.
Does anyone that you've interviewed and talked to, other than people really, really out there on the fringe, believe Earth has been visited at any point in Earth's history? Did you ever find that, or at best are we talking about extraterrestrial life in the form of, say, a Mars meteorite or something like that?
I talked to a couple of, like, UFO kind of people who do think we've been visited, and there are a few of those viewpoints in the book via those people. And yeah, I mean, I talked to people on the Allen Hills meteorite, like some of the people who actually analyzed those results in that famous paper that came out in 1996 that made the front page of the New York Times and everything. It looks like we found life on Mars and this Mars meteorite. And I talked to Gil Levin, who is one of the principal investigators on like the Viking lander mission. And he still claims to this day that, like, his experiment found evidence of the kind of microbial life on Mars. And that's the minority opinion. Yeah. I mean, I do talk to some of those people, both who have strong feelings because of what they think the science has shown, and some people who have strong feelings based on their personal experiences in the kind of UFO sort of realm. But it's much, that kind of latter viewpoint is not all that represented in the book. It's just a couple things here and there. It's mostly the science people.
Here's your first email for the day, and this is from our friend Todd in San Diego. And Todd says, to many, science has become a consensus. We hear this all the time, for example, with climate change, where they say a consensus of scientists say that there is climate change, or the majority of scientists, or 99% of scientists. So rather than a scientific method, for example, consensus seems to serve as evidence of proof for many people in the science community as well as outside the science community. So in terms of extraterrestrial life, be it microbial or be it even sentient, is there a consensus that it exists? Can we bank on there being a consensus, or do we really need to go back to the scientific method and have proof?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think there is a consensus. And yeah, I mean, science doesn't, like, really work by consensus. It's basically, I mean, the, like, consensus emerges from the science, basically. I mean, you have a theory and you do your best to test it and see if it holds up. And if it continues to keep holding up and everybody does their experiments and it still holds up, then you've got a consensus, which makes its way out into the media. And so, I mean, I can see how some people think that it works the other way around, but, like, the consensus generally emerges from people testing, like, a theory and getting the same results over and over again. But with alien life, yeah, I don't think there is a consensus. There's a lot of people, I mean, a lot of scientists are pretty convinced, just based on the numbers game, that there's something else out there, that there's at least, like, some kind of microbial life out there, just based on the numbers that we were talking about earlier. There's about 100 billion stars in the Milky Way, and every one of them has, like, more than one planet on average, and probably a quarter of those could be Earth-like. So you're talking about 25 billion potentially Earth-like worlds. And these are just rough numbers. Nobody knows the real ones, but that's what we think. And so you just look at the numbers game, and then you think about how fast life started here on Earth. I mean, we had microbial life here pretty much about 4 billion years ago, just almost just as soon as it could have arisen, just after Earth actually cooled down enough for it to be able to support microbial life. So kind of based on that, on how quickly it started here on Earth and like how many like potential abodes for Earth-like life there seem to be, it just seems like based on the like numbers game, it seems like there should be something else out there somewhere. But yeah, that's still just a guess though. Nobody knows. I mean, a lot of scientists do have like strong feelings that it should be out there, but nobody I think is making an assumption. I mean, they're still looking for it. I mean, they're still trying to find evidence. I mean, we want to look for it on Mars. We're going to look for it in Enceladus, Europa. And of course, study scientists are still scanning the heavens looking for signals of some sort, you know, light waves, radio waves, something. But yeah, nobody's assuming it. I think people strongly suspect, but yeah, nobody's assuming anything.
Here you got another email already. Jane is in Seattle. And Jane says, recently, there has been a lot of news about this object going through the solar system at very fast speeds. And, Michael, I can't pronounce it, but you know what I'm talking about. Oumuamua, yeah. Whatever. And she says, I have a copy of the Harvard Center of Astrophysics paper by the two scientists that raised the possibility that this object may be of artificial origin. That would mean certainly extraterrestrial. Whether that's true or not, that seems to give a lot of credibility to the fact that there's a high possibility of someplace out there, again, the title of your book, that there must be extraterrestrial life, and how it got into our solar system, of course, remains a big mystery. The object is probably too new to have been included in your book, but have you reported on it? What can you tell us about it? Is it likely to be artificial?
Yeah. I mean, I actually wrote about Oumuamua in the book. It made it in. I mean, I was finishing it up last October, and so I was able to include it. And that study that just came out the other day has generated a lot of buzz. This is a really weird object. This is the first object that we've ever confirmed to have come from another solar system. That's actually in our own solar system. So it's the first confirmed interstellar object we found in our solar system. So that by itself is really cool. And then you have its shape. Like, it seems to be really long and skinny, like a big old rocky needle or cigar. People think it might be like 400 feet long by about 40 feet wide or so. And then there's this motion that the emailer was talking about. It seems to have moved around a little bit in ways that you can't explain by the gravitational pull of the sun or big planets or anything. And that's what this new paper is using as like a jumping off point. Well, what's causing that motion? And the majority opinion is that it probably shows that this object is a comet. And when it got a little closer to the sun, it started jetting out gas and dust as comets do. And those act as little rockets that kind of move it. That's what most scientists think. But this paper is like, well, we don't see a tail, like a comet-like tail or a fuzzy coma around it or anything. And there are a few other reasons why they don't think it's a comet that they explain. So they think that it could be like some kind of alien spacecraft. And I mean, specifically, they think it could be like something called a light sail, which is basically a big, broad sheet of very thin material, thin but strong material, kind of like a piece of tin foil in space, but very big. It actually catches solar radiation and gets pushed along by it like a ship's sail. It's pushed along by the wind. So they kind of throw that hypothesis out there and say how that could work. And it's just a hypothesis. Nobody, I don't think, is seriously claiming that they are claiming that that's really what it definitely is. But it's interesting to actually think about that and to not dismiss that out of hand. I don't think we should dismiss that out of hand. That doesn't seem very scientific to just say that couldn't possibly be true.
Well, it's written by Harvard guys, so of course everyone's going to pay attention to it. But I'm assuming if this had been written by Podunk University or MUFON, it would probably be dismissed. So, there appears to be a pecking order that gives credibility to something. Is there any way, from what you know about science and the field, to test for artificiality with it, to try to find out if it's a comet or, if the Jetsons made it living in another solar system? Are there any kind of test? Are there any kind of spectroscopy, anything that can be done to give us some credibility behind what the object might be?
Yeah, it's really tough because it zoomed through the inner solar system. I mean, we didn't know it was going to be there until it was there, and then now it's zooming away. So we never got a good look at it. Now it's out of sight of even our strongest telescope. And like nobody got like a resolved image of it. Like the shape and size estimates are just estimates. Like nobody got like a sharp picture showing what it actually looks like. We're just guessing based on how bright it was and how the brightness changed over time from observation to observation. So yeah, we don't have enough data to really know what it actually is, probably. People have trained radio telescopes on it to kind of listen for any signals, which if you got radio signals coming from it, obviously that would be a strong sign that it is artificial, but they have not heard anything. And based on the brightness and the spectroscopy that we're able to do, it seems to be kind of reddish, like you'd expect from a deep space object or like a deep space rock whose surface has been turned kind of red by strong radiation. I mean, you see that like in our own solar system among these objects out by Pluto.
I guess it could be a Russian probe messing with our astrobiology field, right? We could be seeing Russian intervention in astronomy. Can Hubble can't see it?
No, it's too far. It's small and it's really far away now. I mean, it's possible if like we invent some kind of new propulsion technology. If for instance, in Breakthrough Starshot, which actually some of your listeners might have heard about.
Yeah, we do a lot of
million dollars.
Yeah, we know.
Yeah, and actually the guy who the co-author on this new Oumuamua paper, Avi Loeb, he's the chief science advisor for Breakthrough Starshot. So in the paper, and like I talked to him for the story that I just wrote about Oumuamua, he suggested that like if Breakthrough Starshot works as planned and they actually can get something up to 20% light speed using powerful lasers and little spacecraft, then it's possible that we could actually launch probes out to Oumuamua to take pictures of it up close and stuff. But we need a breakthrough in propulsion technology like that to like get another look at it, because it's too far away and it's moving too fast for us to catch right now with chemical rockets.
But
they're also saying that this should be like a warning to us, or not really a warning, but like a wake up call. There are going to be more of these objects probably coming through our solar system, so we need to be aware. We need to jump on the next one that comes through and just observe it with as many of our instruments as we can to see what it is.
Well, it's funny that this is the first one ever found. So if others have come through, how in the hell did we miss them?
Yeah, well, it's just we keep getting better and better telescopes, and I'm sure others have come through. We just have missed them. There's a big, powerful survey telescope that's going to come online in a couple of years. It's called the Large Synoptic Survey Telescope, and it's kind of tailor-made to find these sorts of objects, these, like, one-offs. So, I mean, chances are, if these things do commonly zoom through our solar system, it'll probably pick them up.
Another email for you is from our friend, and I'm trying to get your name right, Bjorn, instead of just calling you Bjorn. So I think it's Bjorn, and you can tell me if I'm off in left field again. And he's in Sweden. If human civilization had started out some million years earlier, we would have been all over the galaxy by now. We would have seen ourselves in the stars by now. But the sky looks deader than a rock. What's your take on that paradox?
Yeah, that is a very good question, and people are trying to understand that. That's the Fermi paradox, which is famous. Based on what we were talking about earlier, it seems like there should be something out there just based on how many planets there seem to be, and I mean, a lot of them seem to be suitable for life. And like the universe is so old, it's like 13.8 billion years old. So there's been a lot of time for life to get going and to evolve and for intelligent civilizations to rise and spread. So yeah, that's a big mystery. Why, if there are so many habitable worlds and there's been so much time, why haven't we found any signs of intelligent life or any kind of life? And there are so many different hypotheses to explain it. I mean, I don't think there's a single answer. I mean, the most obvious and simplest explanation, which is often the most depressing, is just that, like, we're alone, right? Like, we're the only intelligent civilization that has ever existed or currently exists, because that's the simplest explanation to why we haven't found anything. But there are lots of other possibilities, too. You know, maybe it's common for there to be microbial life all over, but it's really rare for it to get to the point where it is technologically intelligent and explores the galaxy. And there are corollaries to that, too. Like, why would it be rare once it reaches a certain point? I mean, maybe, like, once you get to the point where you can actually launch super powerful, super fast space probes and explore the galaxy, you tend to end up destroying yourself. You can kind of see that in our trajectory. Like, we've only been technological for like a century or so, and we've almost killed ourselves with nuclear holocaust, and we're doing things to the planet that might claim us in the end now. So there are all these things. And I mean, I don't know the answer to that question. I think there's probably a combination of things. I suspect, my own gut feeling is that like microbial life is common, but it's pretty rare for it to get to the point where it's intelligent and like technologically intelligent. And again, you can base that off of what happened here on Earth. Like, we had microbes by about 4 billion years ago. They stayed microbe only. Life on Earth stayed microbe only for more than 3 billion years after that. And then it wasn't until about 600 million years ago that we started getting multicellular life. And then it wasn't until a few hundred years ago that we got technologically intelligent life. So it seems like there are some hurdles that life has to jump to get to where we are. And I mean, maybe it's not that common for that to happen. And then maybe when it does happen, those species tend to kill themselves. That's just a hunch. Like, I don't know.
Tom sent in a note for you in Tucson, and he says, David, I'm listening at work, so I'm using email. When you read the title of his book, you mentioned antimatter. Michael, are you thinking that we might someday harness antimatter for propulsion? And if so, when and what would that look like? Or were you referring to something else when you put antimatter in the title?
Yeah, that's a reference to kind of how we get out there, which is what the second part of this book is about. You know, how does humanity get out, like, away from Earth and explore the solar system, and then beyond that, go interstellar? And yeah, there are some people who think that we can do it. It's going to be tricky because you have to manufacture it, and it's really expensive to make. And then when it, like, hits regular matter, it, like, it automatically annihilates, so you have to contain it very, very well. But the good thing about antimatter is that if you can harness it, the mass energy conversion is 100%. So it would be an incredibly efficient fuel, which is why Star Trek uses it to accelerate its spaceships for fast speed. But yeah, there are people really looking into it. I don't know. I'm skeptical just because there are a lot of advances that we need to make. It's not a near term answer at all, but it's possible as we get a lot smarter and more technologically adept, maybe a few centuries down the road, it'll start looking like a real possibility.
For those of us that are noticeably getting older, I mean, we're all getting older, do we have any kind of favorable timeline working for us where we're going to have some real, verifiable, concrete answers to extraterrestrial life and maybe even sentient life in a reasonable time period, so a lot of us geezers can still be around to enjoy the findings? I mean, so I'm 72. I mean, I don't I don't think I'm old because my mind is still where I was at 18, but my body certainly isn't. But, you know, I really want to know if there are ETs flying around out there and if there is sentient life out there. I mean, that is like paramount. I would hate to check out not knowing the answer to that question. Is there any chance at all that science or some discipline, hell, even religion, is going to deliver this answer to us in a verifiable way in a reasonable time period, say 10 years, 15 years, 20 years?
Yeah, I mean, I'm pretty optimistic just because, like, what we're learning is basically, like, giving us reason to be optimistic. I mean, not necessarily for intelligent life. That's such a crapshoot. I don't know. I'm kind of agnostic about that. But in terms of simple life, I suspect that we're going to find signs of simple life in our own solar system in the next, I don't know, 15, 20 years. I mean, whether it's extinct or alive, I don't know. But, I mean, I bet some probe will find evidence of some kind of microbial life in like, the oceans of like, Europa or Enceladus or, like, maybe on Mars or maybe in the clouds of Venus. Like, I mean, I think that's going to happen. That's just a hunch. We're just learning that there are so many habitable environments in our own solar system, and that's obviously what we're going to be able to explore first. So I think that the first, like, kind of confirmation that we're not alone is going to come from a discovery of some exotic microbe in our own solar system, and I'm optimistic that that'll happen in, like, 20 years or so. That's just a hunch.
Okay, so let's talk about that. Many people, including Gil Levin, for those of you who aren't up on Gil or all of his Viking research, believe that we have already found evidence of at least past life, if not current life, on Mars, microbial simple life, as you're describing. And, of course, many deny it, and almost every NASA scientist and people I have on the show, and Gil Levin comes up, they are respectful to Gil, but he is dismissed. So if microbial life exists and gets discovered someplace in our solar system, number one, and you do address this in the book, will we be told? How will we be told? Will we be told 20 years after the discovery, or will it leak out or be so important that they couldn't conceal it even if they wanted to? How do you see we lay people, or even we space enthusiasts in the business, getting the concrete information that microbial life or some kind of life has been discovered?
Yeah, that's a really good question, and it'll be a really complicated process, because first of all, it'll probably play out. I mean, this is something that, like, I asked a few different scientists about, and it's surprising because it seems like there would be some, like, august body that would deliver the announcement from on high, like, world, we have this ethical discovery to announce. But it would probably just be like a press conference and a press release, like, from the scientific team who discovered it. Like, I mean, they're the ones who would get to announce the find. It wouldn't come from the UN or from the National Academy of Sciences or anything. It would be from the discovery team. And they would want to get it out there, because it would probably mean, like, a Nobel Prize for them down the road. It would be, like, one of the biggest discoveries in the history of humanity. I don't think there's any way it would be covered up or hidden. I think they'd be eager to kind of get it out. But it's also, it would also, like, generate a ton of, like, debate and discussion, because there will be lots of skeptics, as there always are. Scientists are skeptical people. And there's so much wiggle room that's possible in that kind of discovery, because even if you do see, like, a microbe on Mars or find some signs of like, microbial metabolism, then there will be people who say, how do you know it didn't come with the spacecraft? Or, so, I mean, there will be so many things that you have to answer. And it's, like, tough to say what would constitute, like, a definitive detection that everybody will accept. I don't know. That's tough to say, because even if you get, like, some kind of microscopy of a microbe swimming around on another world, there are still some people who would claim that it could have just come with the spacecraft. So, yeah, it would be really interesting to watch this all unfold. There'll be a lot of debate and a lot of discussion and a lot of, like, back and forth about how we know what we think we know this is. It would be a very interesting debate.
And you don't think, government or NASA or some other force would put a boycott on the information or something like that, you think it would still get out? It would be so big and important.
Yeah. I mean, if it were going to come out, it would probably be so big that they couldn't hold it for publication in like a major journal like Science or something like that. I think they might want to do that. Obviously, the journal would want to hold that to be the like ones who were able to announce it, and it would come out in their publication, which everybody would buy and pay attention to. But I also think it would just be such a big deal. I mean, NASA would definitely, if it was a NASA mission that found it, they would definitely hold a press conference. I mean, all that would go through the scientific team that found it, because it would be up to them to kind of how to get the word out. But yeah, I don't think NASA, there would be no reason for them to try to cover it up or delay it, because it would be great. It would be a huge boost to them. It would be a huge boost to their public image and to their funding probably down the road, because you want to follow that find up. Launch another mission maybe to try to figure out what is the deal with these little microbes that we've discovered, and I don't think there's any way that anybody would want to cover it up. It would be such a huge find.
How do you think governments and people would handle the information?
I think if it's just microbial life on Mars or Enceladus or something, I think people would be interested but not blown away. I think it would not cause panic in the streets or like wringing of hands and soul searching about, oh, like this makes me put all of my religious beliefs and like into perspective, and I need to reevaluate all of my beliefs in my life. I mean, I think we're kind of conditioned to think that that this is a likely outcome, just based on all that news that I've been talking about over the past 10 years, like how kind of likely it is that we're not alone, that there's at least a kind of microbial life out there. I mean, if, like, you talk about intelligent life, then that's probably a little different answer. And then it depends how that discovery kind of comes. If we see a spaceship from another civilization and we definitely know that's what it is, then that's going to be a lot different reaction than, like, a microbe on Mars.
You have two chapters that really intrigue me. So one of them is, what does ET look like, and do aliens have sex? So how do you, even without going to the sci-fi community like Grays or something like that, how do you even get information to talk about what an ET might look like, or do they have sex, or are you just extrapolating from best source information?
Yeah, it's one of extrapolation based on what we know about evolution here on Earth and how it works and how kind of life has Yeah, it's kind of radiated here on Earth. And yeah, I mean, what does ET look like? I mean, I do talk about the Grays a little bit, because it's a sci-fi trope, and there are some people who actually really do think, there are a lot of scientists who really do think that if there are intelligent aliens out there, they will look a fair bit like us, because they like think if they evolved in an Earth-like world, they might evolve to kind of converge with like an Earth-like body form, which we exhibit. There's a whole other group of scientists who don't think that that's true at all, and think that it's all accidental, and they could end up looking like pretty much anything. So I actually talked about that a bit in that chapter, that whole like convergence versus contingency debate, which is more important. It's a lot of speculation, but it's also informed just based on how life on Earth has gone about. And I mean, part of that chapter too is talking about, it seems like we live in an infinite universe. Scientists aren't sure about that, but they think that we do. And if that's the case, and again, if matter is distributed pretty much evenly everywhere, which it seems to be, then like, what does ET look like? It's kind of a trick question, because if aliens do exist and we live in an infinite universe, then pretty much ET looks like anything, because anything that's physically possible will manifest somewhere. So that's a whole other side of it. But yeah, if you are a sci-fi person, then you can really let your imagination run a little wild with that.
Is looking for alien life a priority reason for space exploration? Is it in the top 5 or 10 reasons, or if you were, again, going back to consensus, if you're getting a consensus of planetary exploration or space exploration scientists, where would they rank searching for alien life in terms of why they do what they do or why we spend taxpayer dollars the way we do?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. And, yeah, it definitely varies depending on which people you actually ask. I mean, scientists, I think the majority of them would put it in the top five, definitely. If you talk to sort of policymakers and like lawmakers, maybe not. Maybe they're more interested in the economic implications and the national security implications of space and space supremacy and all that stuff. But if you talk to planetary scientists and who are in this field and are designing space missions and trying to figure out how the universe works, I think they would definitely put it in the top five, maybe even higher than that, maybe top three. Because it is like it's one of the biggest questions we could ever ask. And I mean, maybe the biggest one. And we're getting to the point, and people can sort of sense now that we're getting to the point where we can actually tackle this question in a realistic, meaningful way, both within our own solar system and from like a more theoretical kind of like backbone about what are the odds that we'll find a ping, and what are the reasons why we might not? I mean, as we get to know more about exoplanets and the kind of diversity of solar systems around the universe, we're sort of kind of getting a better handle on that question as well.
What's your take on your journalistic field? Is there a lot of interest in covering the search for alien life? Do they downplay it? Are a lot of your peers really interested in the topic? Does it get the kind of attention you think it warrants?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's one of the things that our readers care the most about, just because it is one of those universal questions. I mean, it's one of those things like we're talking about Oumuamua. That story is kind of going everywhere. People are interested. They're like, wait, what's this thing that could be an alien spacecraft? That's really interesting. I want to learn more about that. So there's a flip side of that, of course. There are a few media outlets that have run with that Oumuamua story in a sensational way, which you expect. That always happens. The more tabloidy side of things are coming out saying it's probably or it's claimed to be an alien spacecraft. So like you always have to tamp down that side of things. But that side of things is like always there, trying to sensationalize things to sell papers and to get clicks.
Your book also on the cover mentions time travel. Where do you sort of stand on time travel? Are we going to see that, or as most people say, it's probably not going to be feasible?
Yeah, that's another active debate, like among physicists. I mean, there's kind of a consensus that it's theoretically possible. I mean, based on Einstein's equations say that it is at least like theoretically, mathematically possible. And there are some physicists who think that it's actually physically possible too, in like a realistic way, like it could be done in our universe under our physical laws. But there are other people who think no, it's not possible. It's not, or at least not feasible. I mean, Stephen Hawking famously had this. He came up with this idea that there are some processes that occur on the quantum level that would prohibit from happening. If you were able to build a time machine, like something would always go wrong and it would never work. There are a lot of people who like think that that's the case. That while it's allowed mathematically, it just cannot work physically. So that's still a debate. I mean, I think it's like most scientists probably think that it's not really feasible, not really practical, and that we'll like never see it. But there are a few holdouts who, or like a few people who think that it could well happen.
Do you know of any credible researchers working on it? Have you ever heard of a grant being given to study time travel?
No, I haven't heard of that. You know, there are some NASA researchers getting money to like investigate warp drives and stuff like that. But that's not a lot of money at all. And I haven't heard anything about any specifically time travel oriented grant.
Yeah, I can imagine putting in a grant request to build a time machine.
that'd be very bold.
Probably might tell you to go to Hollywood and raise the money there. I don't know.
Yeah.
But that would probably be pretty startling, along with the discovery of extraterrestrial life. I think those two things would be pretty shocking to be confirmed.
I think time travel would be more shocking than ET. It would be more surprising.
Yeah, probably because we are being conditioned to accept ET, but I don't see any conditioning going on to accept time travel or visitors coming from the future or from the past or anything like that.
Really?
No conditioning for that. So, as we close out 2018, is there anything that listeners could look for coming up, say, in 2019, out of conventional, traditional, commercial space, anything that we know of what's happening? Kepler has been shut down now, but, of course, the research from Kepler will still be forthcoming. What can we look for to keep us pointing in this direction, or is there anything to look for to keep us pointing in this direction?
Yeah, there are some exciting things coming up in the search for life kind of realm. TESS, which is the Kepler follow-on, it's another NASA planet hunting mission. It launched this past April, and it's actually looking for exoplanets that are relatively close to the sun, and it's already started finding some. And that's exciting. I mean, scientists think it'll find thousands and thousands of planets. And what's really exciting is in a couple of years, if everything goes according to plan, that NASA's next huge space telescope, that the James Webb Space Telescope, that's about a $9 billion instrument, it's scheduled to launch in 2021, and it's going to do a lot of stuff. But like one of the things it's going to do is like scan the atmospheres, hopefully, of some of these planets TESS discovered that are nearby, and it'll be capable of actually looking for gases such as oxygen, methane, and other stuff like that in the atmospheres of some of these planets, hopefully, which could be signs of alien life if any exist. So that's really exciting. Also, NASA's going to launch like another Mars rover in 2020 that's going to look for signs of ancient life, and also Europe and also Russia, they're working together on this project ExoMars. They're going to launch their own life hunting Mars rover in 2020 as well. So there is stuff that's going to be happening in the next couple of years that's exciting and something to actually look forward to.
You think James Webb will actually get going?
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't know. It's been delayed so many times. I don't know. I mean, hopefully March 2021 is when it's actually going to fly. But, yeah, we'll just have to wait and see.
So you're not that's far from a done deal from your perspective, I take it, then?
Well, they're still doing it. Yeah, it's still more than 2 years away. So I won't. Yeah, there's plenty of time for other things to cause a delay. I think NASA is going to do another kind of like investigative report about how it's going. I've just been reading a little bit about that. I don't know. I'm definitely rooting for that to pick it up as soon as possible because it's going to do amazing things. It's been pushed back so many times. I wouldn't be confident saying that March 2021 is definitely going to happen.
Barbara's in Denver. And she says, I'm curious for your opinion. Do you believe we have already found at least past life on Mars, maybe present microbial life? What is your assessment of life on Mars? Or I'm editing her email as we go. In the past or on the future? And then she has a second part. Depending on your answer to the first part, what do you think of the rules for planetary protection? Is this something that is necessary to protect, say, Mars from human contamination? And how would that impact humans getting to Mars?
Yeah, those are both really good questions. And with the have we already found life on Mars, I'm ambivalent. I'm not sure. I mean, I talked to Gil Levin and I talked to the Allen Hills meteorite people. They actually make some pretty good points, but like, of course, other scientists, they explain away those findings. What's most important about those, I think, is that there's still ambiguity involved. And for those finds to be accepted by the scientific community, they're going to have to just be rock solid, and there will have to be very, very little wiggle room in there. And I think that there's still a little too much wiggle room for them to be accepted as, like, the major ethical discovery of our time. It's going to have to be unassailable. And it's not to kind of besmirch the science that was done. Those are difficult things to do. It's going to be really hard to actually make an unassailable claim that we found signs of alien life. And so I think that extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. So unfortunately, I think something that is going to be accepted will have to be a little more unassailable than what those two studies found. I certainly think it's possible that both of those efforts did find evidence of alien life. I think that's one of the possible explanations. I just don't know that we're ever going to see it accepted by the wider community. And with the, planetary protection is a really important question, because we are getting ready to send people to Mars. NASA wants to do it in the 2030s, and of course SpaceX wants to start doing it within like 10 years or so. And that's going to really complicate how we search for life on the red planet. And it's a complicated question too, because I mean, life might be buried pretty deep. If it still exists there, it might be in these buried pockets of water that we think are on Mars. You might actually need people there to search for it. But then you have, I mean, wherever we go, we bring, that's like a trillion microbes with us, and we're shedding them constantly in the environment. So you have this double-edged sword of we could be seeding this other planet with life forms that would complicate, make it a lot harder for us to know if what we find is native. And we're also releasing our own like kind of microbial community there, which could theoretically stamp out whatever native ecosystem is already there. So those are questions that are really, really difficult to answer. And actually NASA is trying to kind of work them out now about what's the best way to send people to Mars and search for life there without screwing both of those efforts up. That's stuff that scientists are trying to hash out now. There are no easy answers.
Listeners, there's still time to call if you would like to do so. It is 1-866-687-7223. And email remains drspace, drspace, at thespaceshow.com. Webb sent in an email from Atlanta and says, I realize we live on Earth and we are in and part of the Earth environment, but life is everywhere. It doesn't hide. A school kid can go to a creek or a pond or a rain puddle and with a cheap little school kid microscope see things in it that are living and swimming around if they want to put water drops on the slide. Why do you think life is so elusive and hard to detect elsewhere? That would indicate to me it just simply doesn't exist. Even if you are on Mars and in the Martian environment, if Earth is any example, if life were there, it would easily be detectable. Yet we can't detect anything.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. And what's different about Earth and these other planets these other worlds in our own solar system that we have access to be able to kind of look at up close is that our habitable environments are just everywhere. We have liquid surface water pretty much across almost all of the globe except the ice caps. And that's just not true. I mean, Mars used to look like that. Mars used to have oceans and streams and so on, but those all dried out about 3.5 billion years ago. But what we think might be happening on Mars is that, I mean, life may have existed there and gone extinct a few billion years ago, or it might still be hanging on in some of these places where there's still liquid water. There's like no liquid water on the Martian surface because they just don't have there's not the atmosphere to support it. And like, we don't think life could survive on the exact surface of Mars because it's got a thin atmosphere and it gets bombarded with radiation and it's cold and so on. But scientists do think that there are pockets of kind of briny, salty water underground. So it's possible that there are only a few like habitable environments left on a planet like Mars, and they're hidden from our view. Like we might have to get really up close and sample those buried aquifers. And that's sort of true of those ocean moons that I was talking about earlier. They have icy shells on their surfaces that are not very habitable, at least as far as life as we know it. But if you go into the ocean, which is buried under that ice, then there, that's what happens when biome scientists think. It's just really hard to sample that environment from afar. So it's, yeah, I mean, that's like a really good point to kind of think about. Life on Earth, like, is everywhere and it's easy to find, but that's because we have habitable environments everywhere. And a lot of these other worlds that we think life may exist on, you kind of have to look harder or think hard about how to sample those habitable environments because they're a little harder to get to for us.
Would that tell you that maybe life just doesn't exist? Or I guess maybe you could really get philosophical and say, well, it's hiding. And maybe it's hiding for a reason. Maybe we're not supposed to know about it here on Earth by whoever's working the grand scheme of life on Earth.
Yeah, well, that's one possible answer to the Fermi paradox. I mean, as far as intelligent life goes, I mean, maybe there's intelligent life out there, but they keep their heads down because they're worried that there might be some other race out there that is more advanced than they are and will attack them and conquer them and, I don't know, yeah, and take all the resources, like enslave them, whatever. That is one possible answer to the Fermi paradox for intelligent life. And it's possible that there are a lot of worlds that are like Earth out there and that they have habitable environments everywhere. Like they're covered with water oceans and thick atmospheres and stuff like that. But we haven't seen a world like that that's close to us, close enough now for us to sample the atmosphere. I mean, we haven't found like any kind of Earth twin. I mean, you find a lot of planets that are a little like Earth, and we haven't found one yet that's exactly like Earth. We're still looking. It's possible there are planets like that out there, and they're far enough away that we haven't found them yet, and certainly haven't studied them in depth yet.
Where would they hide on Earth? If there was evidence of extraterrestrial life that got to Earth, where would it, you have a chapter on where would it hide? Where would it hide on Earth? I mean, are we, let me phrase it a different place. Are there methods and places to look for extraterrestrial life here on Earth that we have not looked at yet?
Well, there are some people who think that there might be extraterrestrial life on Earth that we just haven't found it yet, or there might be a second genesis of life on Earth that we haven't realized. There are people who think that there could be they actually call it shadow biosphere, which would be, there's like a different radiation of life on Earth that has a whole different origin and like a whole different lineage than the kind of common life that we think of now, plants, trees, us. And that's the speculation, but it's not super crazy when you think about it because, I mean, life got started so quickly here. It's not crazy to think it could have happened more than once. And if the shadow biosphere life is very different from Earth life, if it uses different biochemical pathways, if it doesn't use the same kind of energy and food sources, then it might have gone undetected for a while. I mean, because how we culture microbes, we basically culture them kind of based on life as we know it. I mean, we feed them like the nutrients that life as we know it uses. So people who think that there might be an undiscovered shadow biosphere say, well, possible that these like microbes from the second genesis are there and we just don't know how to look for them. They have different genetic material maybe that doesn't show up in our assays. They don't show up in our cultures because they don't eat our food, eat the same food. There are people out there who are actively looking for a shadow biosphere now, and if they like find it, we'll definitely hear about it.
Listeners, if you're looking for a sort of space science, really interesting, fascinating books for your son or daughter for the holidays, this is an incredible book. And I don't know what age it was written for, but I would assume if you have a really curious child and they're interested in space and out there and all of these topics, or at least they're open to them, this is a must-buy gift for them. I see that as a terrific book for your kids for the holidays, as well as for yourself. The whole family is going to enjoy reading it. Michael, is there an age that it's written for, or is it sort of for all ages?
No, it's mostly for all ages, obviously not really little kids, but I mean, I'm trying to make it accessible. It's a popular science book. It's not like a textbook. It's not meant to be for professionals. So anybody who has an interest in this stuff, that's what I'm trying to that kind of reach. There's science in there, but I mean, hopefully it's packaged in an accessible way and people can kind of appreciate the kind of broader strokes of what's going on.
Does the book have a website, or are you going to have a way to get people autographed copies if they want them or something like that?
Yeah. There should be some actually link stuff. If you go to like Grand Central Publishing, that's the publisher. I think that they've got a page up to the book, and like you can learn more about it on the Amazon page. If you search for it on the Amazon Books page, pretty sure. And yeah, I mean, get in touch with me if you're interested. I'm just mwall@ace.com.
Do you have a website yourself?
I do. It's on Medium. There's a site that just got set up for the book. It's actually medium.com, and if you search Medium for me and for the book title, you will probably find it.
Okay. Is there anything we should have talked about or addressed or covered that we've forgotten or omitted or that you want to make sure we know about?
I just wanted to get across, like in the book, why I wrote it now. I mean, you're asking probably the first question is why write about this stuff now? I just wanted to kind of reinforce that we're living through like a very interesting time. And I mean, I just hope people realize that like we're living through a time. If you look back 100 years from now, people might say, might circle this like 5-year stretch we're in the middle of right now is like the time when we really started to understand our place in the universe and really started making real strides toward exploring our own solar system, getting off Earth in a meaningful way. These things are happening right now. And I just wanted to write the book to kind of alert people to that fact and to kind of get them to kind of look up and say, wow, this is cool. I'm living exciting times. So that's sort of what prompted it.
We are in exciting times for space and cosmology and exploration and possible settlement. The most exciting time that I can remember in years, certainly the most exciting time since I've been doing this space show, and we're coming up on 18 years for that. Hold on, I may have just gotten another 11th hour question for you. So our friend in Sweden is asking another question. It seems unlikely to me that an interstellar civilization could coordinate, since light speed communications take thousands of years between the stars, and instruction from a space emperor would be like us reading a wall painting by a pharaoh. If it exists, it must be diverse, and then some of their colonies would do something we would probably not have noticed. So what do you think
about
that?
So I think that's a very good point. That's one of the reasons why I think it would be really hard to maintain control over like a truly galactic empire, because it would be really hard to actually communicate from the central hub out to all the different far-flung outposts. I think that's right. I mean, if there are kind of colonization missions, they might become more sort of like self-contained and might kind of split off from the original founding branch of the empire or whatever. I think that's the recipe for kind of like diversity and for independence of the former colonies. It would be really hard to maintain control from one centralized spot over a far-flung intergalactic empire. That's definitely true.
Absolutely, unless they found a way to go faster than the speed of light, right?
Yeah, and if that's the case, then all bets are off. We have to think about, we have to rethink what we know about the laws of physics and so on and so forth.
Do you have another book in the works?
No, we'll see how this one does and see if they want me to write another one.
The next one could be an encounter of alien life. Do you shake hands or what do you do?
Yeah, right? I would love to be able to actually write a book or a story about we have found alien life, and yeah, that would be amazing. I'm hoping for that too, David, just like you were saying.
Well, I honestly hope it happens, and whether it will or not is way beyond my control. So,
sure.
Michael, great talking to you. It's a fabulous book. I've really enjoyed reading the publisher copy of it, and I hope it does well. And listeners, again, it's really a great book for holiday giving to children as well as to your favorite space enthusiast friend, and I couldn't recommend it more. Back again on Sunday, listeners, so come back for the Sunday Space Show, and we certainly thank Dr. Wall for being with us. Read his article in space.com. He gives us really great, real space news all the time. And everybody have a great weekend coming up. So special thanks to Michael and the Space Show for this program. Keep it safe and keep looking up. And I think we have a holiday on Monday, if I'm not mistaken. It's Veterans Day. But we are doing a space show on Veterans Day this year. So if this is a three-day holiday weekend for everyone, even more of a reason to keep it safe and be aware and alert. Thank you all for being with us today. Goodbye from Michael, David, and the Space Show.